hppodcraft.com.
I collapsed joints and hung up to talk with Dak Wer. He blinked his eyes in some discomfort. "What do you want, Palil?" he asked complainingly. "As if you don't know." "I can't give you permission to examine it. The thing is being saved for inspection by the board. What guarantee do I have that you won't spoil it for them?" I thrust confidentially at one of his body plates. "You owe me a favour," I said. "Remember?" "That was a long time in the past. Only 2,000 revolutions and a reassembly ago. If it wasn't for me, you'd be eroding in a pit. All I want is a quick look at its thinking part. I'll roll a consciousness without laying a single pair of pliers on it." He went into a feedback twitch, an indication of the conflict between his debt to me and his self-conceived duty. Finally, he said, "Very well, but keep tuned to me. If I warn that a board member is coming, remove yourself quickly. Anyway, how do you know it has consciousness? It may be a mere primal metal. In that form, don't be foolish. It's obviously a manufacture, and I'm not conceited enough to believe that we are the only form of intelligent manufacture in the universe."
Dude, do you like to vrull?
Oh, I do now. Mm. Actually, I feel like I'm not somebody who'd be good at vrulling, but I'd be good at saying when it should happen. Vrull him! You know, that's how it would sound if I had some political power and could command underlings. Vrull all of them! Yeah. Or if it was like a street scenario, I'd be like, oh yeah, lackey, vrull this m***er.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I'd be good at that.
Oh, man.
I love silly science fiction words, and they're are just enough in here to tickle me. And when I say in here, talking about Lost Memory, a story by Peter Phillips, a story we are covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast / Strange Studies of Strange Stories. We're here for our patrons on Patreon. I just realized while saying that since we're in this hybrid phase and we cover stories, we're kind of a / fiction podcast. At least for a bit. Who was that reader?
That reader is the amazing Paul Fricker. Paul is one of the hosts of the Good Friends of Jackson Elias podcast. I was just on there a few weeks ago. We talked about Cthulhu and my upcoming book, The Cult of Cthulhu.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, people should check it out. Give that a listen, as well as the book, Cults of Cthulhu, of course, from Chaosium. Paul's kind of a celebrity. I gotta admit, I didn't know who you were gonna select to read. And when I saw his name, I got that rush you get from knowing, you know, you made it. You're recruiting the best talent. I no longer have to say, get me a Paul Fricker type.
Yeah.
I'm getting the real deal, the actual Paul Fricker.
Yeah, well, Paul is well known as being the co-author of the latest edition of the Call of Cthulhu RPG.
Yep.
He also has a couple of great scenarios on DriveThruRPG, one called Full Fathom 5. The other is Dockside Dogs. Also, I just want to mention that he contributed to Cult of Cthulhu as well. He was one of the guys that helped write one of the scenarios.
And now he's big in the slash fiction space. So this is really working out for him. By the way, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
Oh, yeah. I'm Chris Lackey. This author we're discussing here is Peter Phillips. We have not covered his work before.
No, and as you'll recall, we're covering stories from Ramsey Campbell's 80s anthology, Fine Frights, Stories That Scared Me, this month. And this story is third in the collection. It's thematically pretty similar to Child's Play from last week, as will become apparent as we go. Although it's a heck of a lot more fun than that story was. Yeah. We should warn folks before jumping in, there is robot-on-robot violence in the story. Violence to robots done by robots. So for our robotic audience, be careful for all the Roombas that are listening. Let me read from Ramsey's intro. One of the genres horror fiction sometimes encompasses is science fiction. And the following tale is certainly one example. Peter Phillips tells me that he may be writing some new horror stories soon, and I very much hope he does. Of course, that intro was from 1988, so unfortunately, I don't think he did, before he passed away, write much more. Mm-hmm. Well, you tell me. Let's get some bio.
Well, Peter Phillips was born in London, 1920, but was raised up in my neck of the woods here in Yorkshire at a delightful place called Ripon. I've been up in Ripon. It's great. He became a reporter for the Bournemouth Times and then worked as an editor for the Daily Herald. One of his jobs was reviewing crime fiction.
Murder, he vrulled. Very popular show based on that time.
It's a great show. Phillips wrote science fiction mostly between 1948 and 1958. His best-known story is Dreams Are Sacred, from 1948. It's an early story where people enter each other's dreams. So it's kind of new to the genre.
Yeah, early form of that type of thing. Ramsey wrote that it is his best known story, frequently anthologized. Dreams are sacred. It's an early example, not just of that inception, I'm going into somebody's dreams kind of thing, but—
Dreamscape, hello?
And Dreamscape, sorry. But it's also the whole virtual reality genre, because there's in that story, it sounds funny, we might want to cover it sometime. It's about the psychiatrist who's created some dream entering technology, and he's got a patient who's a sword and sorcery author, and the patient has retreated into this mental state in which he's living in the fantasy worlds he's created. So he's in a constant dreaming that he's in that sort of Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatrist is a fan of his books as well as his clinician, so he doesn't want to enter the dream because he's afraid he'll get trapped too. So he's got to get this other guy, the narrator, or the protagonist rather, to go in there and sort things out, try and pull him out of the dream because he's hostile to the fantasy genre. There's a scene in there like with an evil sorceress who's wearing the skimpy fantasy clothing, and the protagonist, who has some power over the dream as well, keeps lengthening her skirt to frustrate the writer, who keeps bringing it back up to a shorter skirt. And they have like a little battle with lengthening and shortening the skirt, which is for 1948 pretty funny. Fantasy art fans such as our reader Paul will very much enjoy that story. I think maybe we should cover it sometime.
Now, in 1949, Phillips wrote a story called Mana, which seems to be pretty funny. Here's the summary from Wikipedia. The tale involves the ghost of medieval monks trapped in an old monastery. They are able to benefit from a modern canned superfood thanks to blurred timelines and engage in poltergeist activity.
That sounds awesome. Medieval monks, you have me. But the fact that there's ghosts and canned food, you know, canning's been around obviously for a very long time, but canned foods do tend to be more popular in times of upheaval. In fact, there was a big drive during World War II to can food at home and in community centers when rationing was in effect. So people were stocking up on canned foods from the stores as well as getting together socially to do it. It is a form of technology, canning food. I think they found 108-year-old canned food before and it was still edible because maybe it didn't smell or taste that great, but since no microorganisms got in there, it didn't ruin the food. And I could just see a science fiction writer picking up the can and thinking, this is wonderful, but are there any unforeseen side effects? For example, feeding ghosts? I mean, Phillips definitely should have written more. This is amazing stuff. His brain's going to great places.
Now, Phillips left the Herald in the early 1960s and lived down in Surrey for most of his adult life. It was believed that he gave up writing, but there are some unpublished stuff of his. A too long for a novella, too short for a novel called Shaggy Dog Story, he wrote in 1980, and something called Alice, Where Art Thou? At some point later, they're not sure when he wrote it. He later moved to Norwich in 2005 to live with his daughter when he was in poor health, and he died in 2012 at the age of 92.
Sorry to hear that. As I said, I wish he'd produce more, and I wasn't the only one. Martin H. Greenberg, who was a popular science fiction editor and anthologist, wrote, if only the urge to write could be controlled by the reader. Phillips is one writer that I really wish would resume his career.
This story you found in an old copy of Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine from May 1952, and it has an illustration by Howard Muller in it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I read it myself in Fine Frights, but it is available in that magazine online in PDF format if folks listening want to read it. That's a great way to read it in an old science fiction magazine. It's also available online in a less pretty version of the anthology Isaac Asimov Presents the Great Science Fiction Stories, Volume 2 from 1986, which is probably a remix because Asimov did a bunch of those in the 30s through the 50s. But that's where I pulled that quote from the editor, Martin Greenberg, who also had this to say. Lost memory is an excellent example of the use of point of view, an approach for which science fiction is tailor-made. Science fiction writers have a variety of possibilities to work with. Aliens observing humans, humans observing aliens, who frequently turn out to be bigger than life imitations of humans. That actually happens in this story. Humans from the past or present observing humans from the future via time travel, and humans from the future commenting on the humans of quote-unquote today. Here, Phillips offers us a truly alien viewpoint, that of intelligent machines. Story also contains a last line that I have remembered since I first read it in Groff Conklin's Science Fiction Terror Tales almost 30 years ago. So he read it back in the 50s. And Isaac Asimov himself also adds in introduction, he writes, sometimes I have a vague feeling that all robot stories belong to me. Intellectually, I know that's not so, of course, but I'm talking about an emotional force within me. I get upset when robots do not behave as I have dictated they ought to behave. I disapprove not only of robots that are evil, violent, disloyal or undutiful, but of the stories in which they appear and of the authors who write them. It's like I wonder who he's talking about. Thus, the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey was ruined for me by the episode where Hal, the computer, kills some of the crew and is itself dismantled in consequence. Contrary-wise and in reverse, I'm interested in the paradox of robots that are essentially good, virtuous, and caring, but who, through circumstances beyond their understanding, achieve results that we ourselves can only see as cruel. Think of the damage that the best of us can do, and do because we are thoughtless, or more frustrating yet, because there are things we just don't know, and perhaps can't know. Read the story, and you'll see what I'm muttering about.
I had the foreknowledge of what this story was about before I read it, but did you?
No, I didn't. All I knew is what Ramsey wrote in the introduction, that it was science fiction and horror. I got to read it with no conception of what it was about, and it did take me a while to puzzle out what was going on in the story. So that revelation was indeed horrific. I felt it.
Yeah.
So if you haven't intuited it yet from what we're talking about, maybe give this a read in that magazine. We've got the link in our show notes before you listen further, if you like, because the discovery, it might be obvious to somebody reading it, but to me, it took me a bit for it to click and definitely gave me an eerie feeling. However, if you don't want to do that, we got you. Let's hear what the story is all about.
It begins with a robot reporter called Palil. He's wanting to get in to see something, and this guy, Darkware, is guarding the place. They have some history, and Darkware owes Palil a favor, so he lets him in.
They're not overtly described as robots. You get that from the phrases like, he thrust one of his body plates, or that was a reassembly ago. Mm-hmm. But this whole reporter trying to get the scoop, you owe me a favor, buddy, is very human.
Yeah.
Or it's very genre. It's what we're used to. Or there's the last line, which solidifies that they are robots, yet also humanizes them when Darkware says, I'm not conceited enough to believe that we are the only form of intelligent manufacture in the universe. Tells you a lot.
And he says he will only roll the consciousness, but he won't put any pliers on it. And we don't get an explanation of what Vrol is. It seems to be some kind of psychic connection or mental link.
I think when R2-D2 plugs his little phallus into the side of a spaceship or whatever, that's Vrulling. It's just jacking into the Matrix. We're Vrulling each other right now, honestly, communicating through machines.
No, I would say that's different because later on in the story, they communicate as you and I are communicating right now, and that's not Vrulling. That's something different.
Come on, man. I just want to Vrull. Why you gotta take it away from me? I know about it. Now it's all I want to do. I guess I never can Vrull, can I?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of talk about logic circuits and robot stuff to communicate that these things are indeed robots, but they still have very human personalities. Palil calls Darkware a fool and a bore. They turn off the radio communication to Darkware, who is supposed to warn them when the board member arrives so that Palil can get out.
Not to cause any confusion, you're using the word they to mean a genderless robot.
Yes.
You're not using it as a plural.
Yeah, not genderless, but gender neutral, because gender is something that pops up in the story, strangely.
Obviously, these robots have enough of a human personality, though, that you wouldn't say it.
No. Now, the object of interest is being housed in a museum shed. Palil describes this thing as being quite beautiful, though slightly damaged from the crash. And I thought this was interesting. In fact, I immediately thought of it as he, and endowed it with the attributes of self-knowing, although, of course, his consciousness could not be functioning, or he would have attempted communication with us. I recently read this discussion where someone felt gender was linked to sex and kept referring to C-3PO as he.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, C-3PO is sexless. He doesn't have any...
He can't reproduce.
No, he doesn't have a penis. He doesn't have a vagina.
That we know of. R2-D2 does.
It's interesting because people like to think of gender as a very binary thing, or, you know, that's changing, but it's not associated necessarily with sex because we do give these robots, these asexual creatures, genders. And it's quite natural for us to do it. I think people refer to R2-D2 as a he, even though he doesn't even have a male voice. He just beeps and tweets and stuff.
Well, yeah, and once you know that these are robots in this story, you would think you'd call it, or, you know, that they're objects. Mm-hmm. But the fact that this reporter says, I think it's a he, tells you that the robots have given themselves gender of some kind.
Yeah, the robots are assuming this thing that they found is a robot as well, but damaged and isn't currently conscious. The board is hoping to disassemble him and figure out how to get him back online.
Yeah, I know you've been studying German recently, where gender is crucial to understanding nouns, you know, the determiners are gender. So everyday objects are gendered, der, die, or das.
Yeah, I talked to a woman who lived in Germany for a while, and she was saying that in Berlin, where she was living, that they're doing away with der and die and using das to try and non-genderize the language, or gender neutral the language.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it works fine in English to have determiners be genderless. But I've wondered about that ever since we started evolving on this language topic. What are we going to do in the languages where table is a he? You know, it's going to be really weird. Also, this robot is vrolling correctly about the sex of this object or the nature of it.
I hate to point this out. You're still using vrolling wrong. He's not vrolling. He's observing and making a conclusion.
No, you're right. It's funny. We're having this like loaded gender language conversation. Then you're like, but if there's something I'm going to point out, you used vrol the wrong way.
Because we don't know what vrolling is.
I know.
It's never explained.
Man. Paul's going to blow me up on Twitter. I don't know who needs to hear this, but vrol means two machines communicating, not a man in a machine.
But it's not two machines communicating because they do that vocally. But when they vrol, there's some interconnectivity that we don't understand exactly what it is. It's different than just talking like we
You're
are
right.
or writing something. Vrolling is...
You will admit that I was correct when I said R2-D2 vrols a machine, though.
That might be true.
As long as we can get there.
They are excited that this thing came from space since their planet doesn't have space travel. They're hoping that this space robot will share with them the secrets of space travel. Halil describes the visitor. He says, he was 35 feet tall, a gracefully tapering cylinder. Standing at its head, I could find no sign of exterior vision cells, so I assumed that it had some kind of rolling sense. There seemed to be no exterior markings at all, except the long, shallow grooves dented in its skin by scraping to a stop along the hard surface of our planet.
And this is when it started to click with me. Well, this is a rocket ship, but they think the vehicle is the visitor.
Yeah.
Not whatever's contained within. And I was, oh no, it's just like a child's play. I kind of saw where it was going.
Now, Palil attempts to roll with the visitor, but is hesitant because the thing's not awake and he feels that might be an invasion of privacy. So he's like, I'm not getting consent to vrol, so I don't know if I should, but this seems like a situation that it might be necessary. So he's desperate and decides to give this rolling a try.
And it's still, we've got that humanoid kind of, he says, I'm a reporter with warm current in my wires, not a cold thinking scientist. It's like, yeah, you're stretching it a little far there.
It says here, I started to vrol gently at first, then harder until I was positively glowing with effort. It was incredible. The skin seemed almost impermeable.
So hot. This is the kind of stuff you should expect from a slash fiction podcast like ours.
That's true. Palil gets a bit freaked out by the alien nature of this thing and becomes frightened. Just then, the museum board shows up. The chairman, Chirik, is annoyed that the reporter is there.
Yeah, he could, because remember, he turned off his radio. Otherwise, his buddy would have warned him. And if his buddy had warned him, we wouldn't have a story. So that's why he turned it off.
Palil is able to fast talk his way into staying during this examination of the alien.
Did you say fast talk just for Paul's benefit, our reader?
I did. It's a great skill in the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Now, each member of the board tries to vrol with this alien, and they're all unsuccessful. Chirik commands that they fetch Fif-Fif, their interpreter.
Fif-Fif can detect anything in the spectrum, any spectrum. And so I thought, well, in the robot world, a name like Pfeiffer probably would mean one who is the boss of Fif-Fif. So in this case, when they track Fif-Fif down at the museum, my robot version would be there to say, vrol him! Just like I suspected.
That's a stretch, but I'll allow it.
Thanks.
Fif-Fif arrives and is able to pick up a transmission and translate it into what they can understand. The visitor is using an unusual frequency, and this is what they hear.
After planetfall,
the stranger was saying,
last dribble of power. If you don't pick this up, my name is Entropy. Other instruments knocked to hell. Airlock jammed, and I'm too weak to open it manually. Becoming delirious too, I guess. Getting strong undirectional ultrawave reception in English. Craziest stuff you ever heard. Like goblins muttering. And I know we were the only ship in this sector. If you pick this up but can't get a fix in time, give my love to the boys in the mess. Signing off for another couple of hours. But keeping this channel open and hoping.
I think it's pretty clear at this point that this is a ship and there's a human on board.
I hoped there wasn't a human on board. And that it was just a ship they found, maybe with a computer record of Earth or something, but it goes the horror direction. That's David Bowie in there. You know, tell my wife I love her very much. That's what Fif-Fif is singing as he's, she knows! Fif-Fif.
The robots don't understand this chatter. Chirik thinks that the visitor is deranged and realizes that it can't see or hear them. Fif-Fif is able to make it so that they can respond.
You know, Bradbury did this perspective shift in the Martian Chronicles, one of the short stories in there where an astronaut lands and the Martians just think he's a crazy Martian. who's projecting this whole personality. Oh. And they put him in an asylum, which really affected me, that story, because it was frightening that the idea, even it's present in a lot of horror. Mm-hmm. You know something's real and everybody just thinks you're nuts, but I'd never seen that done in a science fiction context before.
Right. Chirik welcomes him and offers this visitor some help, but the human is very confused. And Chirik explains that his visual receptors must be damaged. They're also confused as why they can't roll with him, and they want to know why.
Me too.
The stranger said, "I don't know if you're baddie or I am. What distance are you from me?"
I just had the 1950s War of the Worlds movie on in the office yesterday while I was working. It's good background, and Gene Barry in that movie has got the ultimate 1950s Troy McClure voice as Dr. Clayton Forrester. You know he's the actor in that rocket ship. Yeah. "I don't know if you're baddie or I am. How about we share a soda at Jimmy's Diner and roll this out together?" "What do you mean I can't roll?"
They explain the distance, and it seems to confuse them both. The visitor says, "Look, my airlock is jammed and I can't get out. I'm hurt. Please get me out of here." They're confused by this because they're like, "Get you out of where? You're in an open shed." And they tell him they're going to get him to the repair shop and fix him.
This is pretty scary stuff. They think that's the rocket ship communicating with them, not that there's a person, an organic person inside. With both Child's Play and this story in my head, I started calling this the Zoidberg effect. Because, when, you know, Zoidberg is the character from Futurama. There are many entertaining things about Zoidberg. One of the most is that he's the physician.
Yeah.
And has literally no idea about human anatomy or is confident in his misconceptions. I think even in the first episode, he was like, "I'm an expert on humans. Now pick a mouth, open it, and say..." Constantly demonstrating that he doesn't understand biology. Yeah.
Finally, the visitor asked them to describe what kind of creature they are. He understands that they are robots. The visitor is confused as to how they got on this planet and how they're able to speak English. But he says that he is a friend of your maker and that you must get your maker so that I can talk to him.
The fact that they are speaking English suggests to him that it is somebody from his planet who created these things, I thought.
Now, the robots just think that he's lost his mind and tell him that he's going to get repaired soon. The visitor tries to get them to understand, but doesn't understand why they don't have any memory of humans. He starts to lose it, and he gets delusional, I'm assuming due to his injuries and blood loss. Says, "You call me he? Why? You have no sex. You are neuter. You are it, it, it. I am he who made you, sprung from she, born of woman."
Gender is a construct.
Well, I mean, he's kind of belittling them by calling them it. Like, that's intentional here. In his delusion, he asks if they remember the soft little man who conquered the galaxy and made sentient slaves of his machines. He laments that he has to die in lonely desperation on a far planet, hearing goblin voices in the darkness.
This is sort of enough at this point in the story. You know, this horror that they are so far removed from their creators that they don't know what he's talking about is strongly implied. I don't think we need to get too much more into the explanation of it. That was my only complaint about the story, is that it sort of transitions into explaining mode.
Yeah.
You know, this astronaut is in a lot of mortal trouble, but he still has time to go, "I imagine that this is what happened, how this all came to be." And honestly, on the bonus episode last month, I recommended this Gillian Flynn story that I was reading.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it opened up really strongly, and about halfway through, completely turned into that kind of story where it was way more about explaining things. Oh. Yeah, it got really boring. I don't know her other work, but I wondered, is this what Gone Girl was like? Because there is an element of that book that's a little like, is it true? Is it not true? That's totally what that story became. Sorry, a little off topic, but wanted to follow up on that since I had kind of promoted it.
Yeah. The visitor asked them if they know what blood, war, or death is. And of course, they don't know what those things are. And he wants to know where they come from. And they say, well, we've got some theories. One is that their creator fell from the sky and into primal metal and was able to construct the first assembly shop, most likely an interstellar vehicle of some kind. It is said that he, the original machine, was large and cubical, static in himself. Now, the stranger seems to understand this was a machine that didn't like being under the control of men, came to this planet, made offspring, but deleted all history of man to keep the palate clean of the evil human influence. The visitor asks what happened to the manufacturer, and Chirik tells him that after he got everything set up, he fused his circuits together, destroying himself.
Seems plausible, and none of this is a terrible idea. It's hipster ironic thing to say, I welcome our robot masters, but I don't know. With humanity so far, I'm not too impressed. If they turn out to be like nice robots like this,
they really seem like they're trying too here.
Yeah.
Now the visitor asks what the planet is like. Is there any green? And the robots don't even know what he's talking about. And he tries to explain, but he seems to be drifting out of consciousness. They take that as a critical failure and cart the ship off to the repair facility. The reporter notes that the doctor that day was a robot called Churcher, an old friend of his, and they ask the stranger to tell them where to open, and he groggily tells them that he's trying to get on his suit. There's no oxygen on their planet, and they say, oxygen? Ooh, no, that causes the dreaded rust. We don't want any of that. So they ask him where his thinking parts are on his body, and the stranger says, my head. And they hear him grunting and struggling to get to the airlock, but they don't understand what the sounds are because obviously they don't grunt or wheeze or make any of those types of noise. And he tries to get them to open up the door for him.
I mean, he is having just as much of a perceptual problem as them because it doesn't even enter his mind what they're doing. He doesn't think, oh, they think the rocket ship is the entity, because if he could tell them that, or even just try and talk in their terms and say, I'm the brain inside.
Yeah.
This is how you safely get me to communicate with you better. But they're just, he doesn't get it either.
Well, he's messed up. He's barely conscious. They use a welding arc and begin to cut open the airlock. The stranger screams, no, no, it's too hot. I can't, back away. And they tell Churcher to stop, and he says, look, this is the only way to help him.
As far as I can tell, Ramsey Campbell, we'll have to ask him, but it seems like he's extremely frightened by people not understanding things, but sawing anyway.
Oh, I am.
Yeah, this is our robot reporter's account of this sawing.
Stop, Churcher, I pleaded. The heat has somehow brought back his skin currents. It's hurting him. Churcher said reassuringly, sorry, Palil. It occasionally happens during an operation, probably a local thermoelectric effect. But even if his contact senses have started working again and he can't switch them off, he won't have to bear this very long. During the 1.5 seconds since I had recorded the distinct vocables burning me alive, the stranger's words had become quite blurred, running together and rising even higher in pitch until they reached a sustained note around E-flat in the standard sonic scale. It was not like a voice at all. The high, whirring noise was suddenly modulated by apparent words, but without changing its pitch. Transcribing what seemed to be words is almost impossible, as you can see for yourself. This is the closest I can come phonetically.
Ah, being baked alive in an oven, ah, dear Jesus, mother!
Oh my God.
Oh man. Called for his mom.
Oh gosh. Churcher finishes the cut and opens the side. All the smoke comes out, and it says, the fumes came from a soft, charred, curiously shaped mass of something which lay just inside the opening. Undoubtedly a kind of insulating material, Churcher explained. But of course, there was no more insulating material to be found in the ship, they note as odd. Churcher gets in and begins repairs and goes inside to see what's there. And it says this, but this is my personal non-scientific account. I shall never forget hearing about the greatest mystery of all, for which not even the most tentative explanation has been advanced, nor the utter bewilderment with which Churcher announced his initial findings that day.
I have examined the central brain in the fore part of his body. It is no more than a simple auxiliary computer mechanism. It does not possess the slightest trace of consciousness, and there is no other conceivable center of intelligence in the remainder of his body. There is something I wish I could forget. I can't explain why it should upset me so much, but I always stop the tape before it reaches the point where the voice of the stranger rises in pitch, going higher and higher until it cuts out. There's a quality about that noise that makes me tremble and think of rust.
And that's the end of the story. Mm. It's to their benefit that they incinerated the man, I suppose, because the thing he asks to find out if they're human is he's like, do you know anything about blood or war? You know, these are the things that would make them human. It reminds me a bit of Color Out of Space as well. Let's just hit this meteorite and see what pops out.
Oh,
and,
right,
you know, whatever that reaction was, we still don't understand. So it was a similar thing where what was inside the meteor, maybe the meteor itself was the being, or it was the bacteria that came off of it, or it was just the color of it. It's truly alien. So we can't know if it's the structure or what's inside. I mean, such an interesting thing that we've discussed plenty of times about aliens that's expressed in a reverse manner to really drive it home.
Yeah.
The fact that somebody would think the car is the person and not the driver. It's great.
It's a really cool story. It's good sci-fi, shifting perspective, giving you a different way of looking at things and making you appreciate or understand your world in a different way.
I can definitely understand why it's a classic. And I hope that we can do some more stuff by Phillips, because I really like this.
Yeah. I want to thank our reader, Paul Fricka, because he is amazing.
He's a great guy, and I hope you'll all go listen to his podcast.
Yes, The Good Friends of Jackson Elias. It's a fun show all about the Cthulhu role-playing game. So if you're into that stuff, it deep dives into it in a very interesting and fun way. And these guys know what they're talking about.
I'd like to take a deep dive into some of our patrons.
Mm.
I selected 10 of them here to specially thank, and I'm going to start by thanking Shelby Wheeler.
Alex Liggett, thank you.
Mitchell, thank you so much.
Anya Penfold, thank you very much.
Travis, thank you.
Caden Kotzman, thank you very much.
Ryan Thomas, thank you.
Hey, Chris Brown, thank you.
Hernal, thank you.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Joaquin Berman.
You guys are all great. Thanks for supporting the show. We're going to be back next time with a story called Chilton Castle. The Horror at Chilton Castle. Is that what it's called? It's a good one. And I think you all will enjoy it as well. So I hope you'll stay with us and tune in. That's all we have for today. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Slash Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Exclusively on Patreon. HPPodcraft.com.